not important. Timing is more important than budget. If you got the right timing, figure out the budget. So I've learned.
I got reserves. Am I volunteering to give it away today? That's what they're for.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to take you live here. So when you see yourselves come up on the screen, you'll know you're live.
All right, good evening. This is the September meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. Welcome those who are here with us tonight, and we're so glad that you are. First order of business is to approve the minutes of the last two meetings, the June meeting and the July meeting. There was no August meeting. So are there any additions or corrections to those minutes? There being none, then they stand as published. Oh, did you? I'm sorry.
I just have one on one of the attachments from the retreat meeting on the liaison assignments, the Oral Health Coalition. I don't remember that I'm on that. Huh? Yeah. I don't mind being the third person, but Claire, I think, usually goes, and if Chris can go, then if neither one of you, I would be happy to do that. But Tuesday's kind
there,
of a hard
there day. Also now is a San Luis Obispo Coalition of Compassionate Care that started up again, and Jean and I are trading off on that one, just like we're trading off on the Pulsed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like we're well represented all the way around.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah. We'll have people in attendance.
All right. So there's no correction. Is that my understanding? You're going to leave that as it stands?
Yeah, as long as I'm an alternate.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We're good. So the minutes will stand as published. Next is the public comment period, the time when members of the public may make a comment on anything that is not on our agenda. And you have 3 minutes. So we have, please state your name.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Susan Warren, and I am, I'm from Cambria, and I'm a person in long-term recovery. And September is Recovery Month nationally, and I just like to read the proclamation that we have this month. In honor, and it's Join the Voices for Recovery, Visible, Vocal, and Valuable. Each September, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services sponsors National Recovery Month to increase awareness of behavioral health conditions. This observance promotes the belief that behavioral health is essential to health, prevention works, treatment is effective, and people recover from mental and or substance use disorders. Here's some facts I want to read. One, on average, more than 33,000 Americans died each year between 2001 and 2009 as a result of suicide. That's more than one person every 15 minutes. The first behavioral health symptoms typically precede a mental and/or substance abuse disorder by 2 to 4 years, offering a window of opportunity to intervene early and often. Third, two-thirds of Americans believe that treatment and support can help people with mental illness lead normal lives. And this is the most striking to me. And by the way, on the back, I have all of the resources where you can find these facts. By 2020, mental and substance use disorders will surpass all physical diseases as a major cause of disability worldwide. The 2015 Recovery Month theme, Join the Voices of For Recovery, Visible, Vocal, and Valuable, highlights the opportunities for recovery education, support, and celebration. The theme encourages communities to be visible by knowing the prevalence of mental and or substance use disorders, be vocal by noticing warning signs and symptoms, and be valuable by raising awareness of the resources available to help. Each year, millions of Americans experience mental and or substance use disorders. Seeking help can be challenging, especially when people fear discrimination and often feel isolated and alone. Knowing that there are peers to help in the recovery journey can be immensely empowering. Research shows that peer support facilitates recovery and reduces health care costs. Peer recovery supports self-efficacy through role modeling by those who have traveled the same path. Ongoing peer recovery support can help individuals regain meaning, purpose, and positive social connections. Visible support systems make a difference. Recovery is defined as a process of change through which individuals improve their health and wellness, live a self-directed life, and strive to reach their full potential. Vocal, connect those in need to treatment services. A person with a mental and or substance use disorder may find it difficult to take the first step toward finding help, but being vocal about supporting the individual can make a positive impact. Recognizing the signs and symptoms of a mental health and or substance use disorder is the first step toward getting help. Valuable, treatment and recovery support services, intervening early before behavioral health problems progress, is among the best and most cost-effective ways to improve health. Mental and or substance use conditions that progress are complex and have several dimensions. Treatment for mental and or substance use disorders is provided in different settings, including outpatient, residential, and inpatient, based on the nature and intensity of care required. Proven and effective treatments include behavioral treatments, medication-assisted therapy, and recovery support services. So tonight we're asking the citizens of SLO County to join the recovery community in a focus on the provision of additional behavioral health care services for early intervention, treatment, and recovery support to meet the current and future needs of our family members, employees, neighbors, friends, and fellow county residents. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Very nicely said.
Thank you.
Are there any other people who wish to make a public comment? There being none, we will move on into our program for tonight. I will introduce Kurt Batson from our Environmental Health Services Department, who will then introduce everybody else. Thank you very much for being here.
Good evening, Chairperson Enns, members of the Health Commission. It's good to see you again. I haven't been here in a little while, but I seem to be the person who never goes away, except that I am. I'm soon to be retiring, actually. But this evening, we're here to talk to you about water. I know that it's on everybody's mind, or the lack thereof, actually, is what's on everybody's mind. And so we were asked to come and give you some perspective on the county's water issues and the capacity that we have for actually being able to analyze pieces of information to make some decisions. And then I'll conclude with some public health impacts of drought on our community. So I have Mark Hutchinson, Deputy Director for Public Works. He'll be presenting the general overview of water and drought in the county. I have Gina Herbst. She is our GIS analyst for environmental health, and she'll show you a little bit of the capacity we have for taking information and putting it in a graphic way to represent and or analyze. And then I'll finish up with the public health impacts. So without any further ado, I will introduce Mark Hutchinson.
Thanks, Kurt. Ooh. Good evening. I'm Mark Hutchinson. I'm the deputy director, one of now three for the Department of Public Works. I head up what we call our resources group, oversee our environmental programs, our utilities, water, wastewater, delivery systems, flood control operations, and our topic for tonight, water resources. I briefly, we only have an hour, so this has to be brief. We want to zip you through an overview of our drought conditions in the county, look at county water systems, talk about groundwater conditions a little bit, since that's in the news, and then just a little bit about the county's response to date on these issues. This is the latest U.S. Drought monitor for California that shows the depth of the drought that we're in. As you can see, San Luis Obispo County remains in what's called a D4, which is exceptional drought. We look back over the last 4 years, we can see how this has progressed. I noted, since this is the Health Commission, it looks like some sort of growth that began in our county and has infected most of the state over the years. We get the fingers pointed at us at those statewide meetings. The other water managers will look at me and say, started with you guys. You have to, it's your responsible to fix this. You will note that it has mitigated somewhat because of the rains that we had last winter, primarily in the northern part of the state. Certainly no snowpack of any kind developed, but the reservoirs were so low that nearly all of the runoff that was generated in the Cascades and Northern Sierra ended up in one reservoir or another. So the rule that our water is dependent, at least on a statewide basis, on snowpack doesn't necessarily hold true in a drought when the reservoirs are, in fact, nearly empty. Federal government has this prediction for their seasonal drought outlook. This is from the end of August, and it shows drought conditions continuing in the western U.S., but you note that this is only valid through November 30th. And what we hear in the news, of course, is El Nino, and certainly El Nino conditions are present, and we do have statistically a greater than 90% chance of El Nino continuing through this winter. Hence, our department is now doing a little bit of overtime as we continue to deal with the drought and some of our emergency water supply efforts, but we're also moving into the flood planning season, and we'll be out in the community talking to people about flood prevention, some of the actions we're taking, and then the recommendations to remind people of what happens when it does rain. This is an interesting graphic that's been shown around quite a bit. You can see November 1997, the warm water and the earthquake are around the equator that signals drought. And then we see July 2015, very similar patterns, very similar temperatures. But then we look off of our coast of this, the technical term now from the client scientists is the blob, the warm water off of our coast. We've been listening to some of the webinars that are coming out of the East Coast, the National Weather Service and their centers, and also John Lindsay. I've sat in on a couple of his presentations most recently in the South County, where the cities down there put on a water workshop for their communities. And I can almost quote John saying that when you talk to all the climate scientists and say, what does this warm water off our coast mean, they are in agreement. They don't know. And then John, of course, looks at the audience and says, do you remember 1862, and walked off the stage? Kind of an interesting thing for a weatherman to say. 1862, 1863, I was not around, and I don't think anybody in the audience was, although we accused Jim Gehring, our senior water historian, of being there. All John would remind everybody, that was the year that the San Joaquin Valley flooded, and they moved the state capital from Sacramento to back to San Francisco. And that lake from Bakersfield all the way up to the Williams Northern Valley area persisted throughout the entire summer, which I guess if you're in the water supply business is good, but if one of your duties is flood control, is not what I want to hear from John. I don't know if he was just speaking to me about that or not. So it is an unknown. We don't have data, of course, going back that far. We do know that in 1997 the temperatures were not there. We do know that sometimes in 25% of El Niños, normal El Niños, there is less rain on the Central Coast. So our drought planning continues as if the drought that we've seen in the last 4 years, which in our county is at unprecedented low precipitation levels, may continue through next year and perhaps beyond. So with that, I'll shift gears a little bit, and we'll do a quick overview of systems, water systems that San Luis Obispo County itself is responsible for. The colored lines on the map up there show the major water infrastructure projects that exist in the county today. The blue line, starting in the northeast, is of course the state water project, comes in near Highway 46 through Shandon, down to the Cuesta Grade, and through the South County, intersects the Lopez Lake system, and then continues on into Santa Barbara County. San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District is the local state water contractor, and I need to stop there and do a sidebar for a moment. You may hear me say Flood Control District or County. The San Luis Obispo County Flood Control District is a special district formed in 1958 by state action. It covers all of San Luis Obispo County. It is a separate agency from the county, but it has the same five board members as the county. And it has no staff. All of its staffing is provided by the San Luis Obispo County Public Works Department. So while I am a Public Works County employee, I spend a significant amount of my time working on what we've shortened as Flood Control District or Water Conservation District activities. So contractually, that district is the contractor with the state that brings state water into the county and then subcontracts to numerous agencies up and down the line. So hopefully I don't use the terms too interchangeably. But back up to the map, the red line, the Nacimiento project, recently completed and then broken and then repaired and put back in operation, also a district project. The county has rights to 17,500 acre-feet of water in Nacimiento. That is by agreement with the County of Monterey. Long history there, but we refer to it as the 1959 agreement. It puts us in a good position with that lake in that we essentially have the rights to the last 17,500 acre-feet in the lake and the first water that flows in. So last winter, as an example, the first two winter storms, and we basically only had two winter storms, the inflow into Nacimiento Reservoir exceeded 25,000 acre-feet in just those two brief rainstorms, which is more than enough to supply all of San Luis Obispo County's share of the water that's in the lake. Monterey County then gets the water off the top, and we get that last little bit contractually. And there's a long litigation history behind that and political negotiations from the 1950s that settled that. So that system is up and running. It delivers non-potable, untreated water to Paso Robles, Templeton, Tascadero Mutual Water Company, City of San Luis Obispo, and then through an exchange agreement with the City of San Luis Obispo to the southern part of Cayucas, what we call County Service Area 10. We can talk a little bit about that later in the presentation. We see the green line near the bottom, the Lopez Lake system. This is also another district project. The dam there built in 1968-69 and supplies a little more than 50% of the water supply for the cities of Arroyo Grande, Pismo, and Grover. Also includes Oceano Community Services District, and the main line runs over the hill to the Avila Valley. We have 16 customers in the Avila Valley, including the town of Avila, some small mutual water companies, and several estate properties that are actually contractors. That water is treated by the district as potable water and delivered as drinking water supplies to those communities. The total average annual supply at 44,530 acre feet is a little more than half their normal annual use, which is about 8,250 in the South County. Interestingly, we also deliver state water to Pismo Beach and Oceano and Avila Beach CSD through the same distribution system. So the water gets mixed near the treatment plant at the base of the dam and then delivered out. You'll see a blue line in the middle out to Morro Bay. Morro Bay is a state water contractor. As well as the Chorro Valley institutions. And then what you don't see is a water line from the Whale Rock Reservoir at Cayucas back to San Luis Obispo. That project's operated by what's called the Whale Rock Commission, which is a partnership of the California Men's Colony, City of San Luis Obispo, and the other one, Cal Poly, those people. And then we have the yellow line in the middle, the Santa Margarita Lake, or what we call the Salinas Project. fairly small reservoir as things go. That reservoir is owned by the U.S. Army. It's operated by the County Flood Control District exclusively for the benefit of the city of San Luis Obispo. And I've asked questions of the old-timers to find out why the city operates Well Rock on behalf of the Well Rock Commission, but the county operates Salinas on behalf of the city. And foggy recollections there, but it seems to work for everybody concerned, so we continue to do that. Also, you'll see something at the top, CSA 16, County Service Area 16. That's the water system in Shandon. County Service Area 23 at Santa Margarita, and County Service Area 10, and it should say 10A in Cayucas. The county, not the flood control district, is the water purveyor in Shandon, in Santa Margarita, and then for the southern portion of Cayucas, that's 10A. CSA 10 is a water treatment plant, so the county treats all the water for the other four water purveyors in Cayucas, and then we are our own customer for the southern part of town, from about Old Creek to the south. The reservoirs we talked about have performed this way in the last couple of years, generally a downward trend. The percentage numbers are percent of capacity of water in the reservoir. And you can see the bump up from Nacimiento from last winter's very modest rains. We'll have more detail about each reservoir because the percentages can be meaningful in some cases. And in other cases, not meaningful at all, depending how the reservoirs are operated. Another graphic that shows the same drought situation. Those vertical bars are correct in scale in comparing one to another. The blue was the amount of wet water in the reservoir as of the middle of August. The red line is the average amount for this time of year, averaged over the life of the reservoir. So from Nacimiento from 1959 and Well Rock from the early 60s and Lopez from 69 and then of course the Salinas Reservoir, Santa Margarita Lake from 1942. It's important, I guess, to understand when you see percentages on a graph to understand that a low percentage in Nacimiento translates into a substantial amount of water. Which is a key thing when we're actually talking water management across the county. So we'll take a quick look at Nacimiento Reservoir. Capacity is 377,900 acre feet. So it holds more water than the other three reservoirs combined. Its current storage last week was about 83,000 acre feet. Which is about 22% full. It lost about 1% of its capacity over the last month. But the county share is 17,500 acre feet, and long-term analysis shows the reservoir should be able to deliver that 100% of the time. Even when we project the drought conditions we have now, working with Monterey County on their management of the reservoir, we work forward with 17,500 on an annual basis, and that's what our planning considers. As I said before, City of San Luis Obispo, Paso, Tascadero, Templeton, Cayucas, so we have a population of about 114,300 people that are partially dependent on Nacimiento water supplies. Well Rock Reservoir, again, as we said, the Well Rock Commission operates. It looks pretty bad. Down at about 39%. The reservoir only holds 39,000 acre feet. It's important to note that on the one hand, it's operated by the city, and the city's share is part of a portfolio that the city owns. They own the water in Salinas Reservoir, Santa Margarita Lake, a portion of this reservoir, about half, and they are also a Nacimiento subscriber at about 3,800, almost 4,000 acre feet. So they'll operate those three sources, sometimes relying on one more than the other. They don't bring them down evenly because just for their own water management purposes, sometimes pipeline maintenance, sometimes normal rate of decline. For instance, we'll see Santa Margarita Lake very low. City tends to rely on that heavily because the evaporation rates are so much higher than they are at Whale Rock. At the same time, the California Men's Colony operates, again, on a portfolio basis with Whale Rock and state water supplies, but then Cal Poly, solely dependent on Whale Rock. The reservoir is divided contractually into shares, essentially, so they know from day to day and year to year how much water each entity has in the reservoir, and so far it's working out. The community of Cayucas has an allocation of the reservoir of some 600 acre feet, which exceeds their use even in non-drought conditions. That's a water right that predates the reservoir. So that is piped from the reservoir into the county's treatment plant and delivered to all of the water entities. So Cayucas, primarily because of the reservoir and one they didn't have to invest in, is actually in a very good position as far as water use goes. Lopez. Now this one is interesting. Built by the district 1968, filled and spilled in 1969. Reservoir holds about 50,000 acre feet. We have this wonderful data set that's taken daily of inflows and outflows and evaporation, water treated, water released downstream that goes back to 1969. We've recorded at least two winters where the watershed has generated more than three times the capacity of the reservoir. So it has the capacity to fill up quite rapidly. It is not a flood control facility. It does that kind of accidentally. But it is a major water supply for Arroyo Grande and Grover, Pismo, Oceano, and Avila. The total population serves about 48,000 and is about, give or take, about 55% of the water supply of the South County. Contractually, those agencies, although the reservoir is predicted or calculated to produce about 8,700 acre feet, their contracts limit them to 4,500 acre feet. The rest is downstream use for water rights for adjacent farmers because it's a major water supply, especially for the upper Rio Grande Valley. The partners in what we call Zone 3, which is the Lopez project, through their technical advisory committee and also the advisory committee itself, have done a lot of work. We started planning for drought in 2006 and created a document called the Low Reservoir Response Plan. And this is just one slide from the latest iteration of that plan. We looked at reservoir performance based on four different drought scenarios. And those four colored lines are actually tracking actual drought periods that we've seen going back to 87 to 92 drought is the oldest one, putting together different mixes. We applied the most stringent water delivery reductions that we could, understanding that in the South County, the other major source, they have some state water, the other is groundwater, and groundwater supplies in the northern portion of the Santa Maria groundwater basin that supplies the South County are dropping quite rapidly. Portions of the aquifer near Oceano are below sea level, within 4 to 5 feet. We're tracking that very carefully with our partners there. So the agencies are relying on heavy conservation and Lopez Reservoir in lieu of overpumping the groundwater. But they have reduced their use of Lopez by 10% below their contracts. So if we apply those to the reservoir elevations and continue different drought scenarios, we get this graph. Unfortunately, what we see trending based on the climate and inflow of the reservoir is the red line. We are just above 15,000 acre feet in storage. So this shows the reservoir hitting what's called minimum pool in about 18 months from now. In response to that, the county and the South County agencies, Zone 3, are developing what's called an extreme drought mitigation plan, which will be presented to their advisory committee this Thursday night down in Grover Beach, and start working on prioritizing some of the actions that we could possibly take to move additional water into the South County. And it includes certainly higher rates of conservation. It includes perhaps purchasing water rights from farmers and fallowing land to access more groundwater. Also includes the Board of Supervisors' recent project to negotiate with PG&E to potentially pipe desalinated water from Diablo Canyon. It's about a 7-mile run from the power plant to the end of the Lopez distribution line, and actually pipe that water into the distribution system. Right now, that plant could produce about 500 acre feet, and with some changes, up to 1,000, which is about 25% of what Lopez needs to deliver. So you can see there's a serious consideration to water management in the South County going on almost weekly. Then we go to the Salinas Reservoir. You know, when it rains, the press always calls us up and wants to get our pictures of water spilling over the spillway at Salinas Reservoir, and then people talk about what a wonderful reservoir, and then the water engineers will tell me it's way too small. It shouldn't spill that fast, but nevertheless, it does. And again, this is part of the portfolio for the city of San Luis Obispo. They relied heavily on the reservoir this year because we did have that failure in the Nacimiento line that put it offline for nearly 8 months before we were able to get up and running again. So all the way down to 14%, only 3,400 acre feet in storage. It's quite a sight to see. Although it was actually lower in the 1992 drought year, when again the city had to rely on that water supply quite heavily. But we expect with any kind of a normal rainfall year for that reservoir to fill up, which again is one of the reasons why the city draws it down, to create more storage and save their other supplies, primarily in Well Rock and then some in the Nacimiento system. This is an interesting graph. It comes out of a document that comes out every 2 years from the State Department of Water Resources. And it's a detailed statistical analysis to try to predict how much water the state water project will deliver. San Luis Obispo County has an allocation from the state of 25,000 acre feet, but we only have customers for 4,830 acre feet. So what it means to us is if the state water delivery is 20% or more of our contracted amount, our subcontractors get 100% of their deliveries. So as I mentioned, you know, Morro Bay is nearly 100% dependent on state water. The Chorro Valley, that's the prison, Cuesta College, the military department, the county operations center is about 50% dependent on state water. And then the South County through the Zone 3, about 25% dependent. The state's always concerned with the 2,000, and you notice the term TAF acronym stands for 1,000 acre feet. The state water project's is supposed to deliver up to 4 million acre feet. So they look at the percentages of getting halfway there and came out with a number of 74% chance. When we use the same graph and upset the statisticians doing, it shows that to get to our 20% that we need to make everybody whole, the state's predicting a 94% chance of meeting their state water obligations for San Luis Obispo County. It sounds good, but the 2013 estimate was a 79% chance of delivering at least 50%, and the two following years they delivered 5% and 20%. We made it through because the district has some storage rights and actually owns wet water both in the San Luis Reservoir and in Lopez. That we move around to meet our customers' needs. We did see this year the state doing what we all agree is a much better job of being innovative with their water movement across the Delta in order to get that number up to 20%, which for our county is the magic number. But the rain in the northern part of the state was the real savior to that. So as reliable as the projection is, it's the best we have. So that's what we go with. So quickly, groundwater, and we'll talk about DWR a little bit. You see the phrase Bulletin 118, which is actually a report that the State Department of Water Resources assembles and puts out on a periodic basis. It's supposed to be updated every 2 years. They usually make every 5. and they look at all the groundwater basins up and down the state that they've delineated based on criteria that the state of California has developed. So in San Luis Obispo County, there's 22 groundwater basins. Within those 22 basins and within the some 500 basins across the state, they are categorized as either being high priority, medium, low, or very low priority, which doesn't necessarily give you a perfect idea of their condition because some of the criteria is population served, value of agriculture used, as well as groundwater level. So in our county, just five of the basins are ranked medium or high. Those that are low and very low, the state does not track as closely, and with the recent groundwater management legislation, they are not required to develop groundwater management plans. However, we know that for some of their grant programs, an agency relying on groundwater has to have a groundwater management program anyway, even if it's not required by this particular law. And fortunately, Cambria is in that boat, so they do have a groundwater management plan for the groundwater that they use there. The five in our county, of course, Paso Robles, which is a sub-basin of the Salinas Valley Basin, and it's ranked high priority for the state. The Santa Maria Basin, there in the southwest, which extends down into Santa Barbara County as well, as a high priority. Los Osos, a high priority basin. And then something called the San Luis Basin, which extends from the watershed out on Los Osos Valley Road all the way through the San Luis, city of San Luis. We're actually over the San Luis Water Basin here at the courthouse, and then includes all of Edna Valley. The state considers a medium priority basin. And then out to the east, you see the Cuyama Valley Basin. In addition to the high, medium, low, and very low ranking, the state back in 1980 came up with a new category called critical conditions of overdraft, which state legislation required DWR to come up with that criteria and list the basins. It didn't require any action. So the Cuyama Basin was listed in critical conditions of overdraft in 1980, and nothing has happened in the intervening 25 years. 35 years, I don't think. But with the new groundwater legislation, the state's decided that if you're in critical conditions, you have to have your groundwater management plan done in 2020 instead of 2022, so it moves the timeline up. They've also reassessed that designation and proposed that both Paso Robles and Los Osos be added to the list of critical conditions of overdraft, based again on state criteria for rate of decline of the basin or part of the basin. Remains to be seen there in the public comment period, so we don't know if they'll stick with those designations. But the immediate effect is that the groundwater management plans will be due 2 years earlier than they otherwise might be. Back in January, staff developed something called a Sustainable Groundwater Manage Act strategy for the Board of Supervisors, sitting as the Board of the Flood Control, to adopt. And it was intended to guide the staff in how we would approach creating groundwater sustainability agencies for those five basins, and also how we would go about creating groundwater sustainability plans for the basins. A presentation on SGMA is its own hour and a half issue. It's kind of fun, but we don't have time for it tonight. Just to say that where we're headed is that those five basins will have specific new local public agencies called groundwater sustainability agencies will come together. They will write groundwater sustainability plans. They'll be due in 2020 or 2022 under state oversight. They'll have to define a sustainability target, justify that to the state, reach it within 20 years. So now we're out to 2040 and 2042. With a planning horizon of 50 years. So the state's out to do long-term groundwater sustainability planning. We put in the board's strategy the phrase, no one size fits all. It's turning out to be a very good prophecy because all five basins are going in five different and interesting directions. This one, the Santa Maria Basin, the dark green is in San Luis County, the light green's in Santa Barbara County, has been adjudicated by the courts. It's divided up into three management areas. It is in Sigma listed as exempt from the requirements to do a GSA or a GSP, except for the parts of the basin that are outside the adjudicated area, because the court's definition of basin doesn't match the state's definition of basin. And that brings us to the Napomo Valley, Arroyo Grande Valley, and a little bit above Pismo. So we're working with the affected local agencies down there to come up with an organization, and then looking forward to a plan to come up with a sustainability plan for the remnants, as we call them, that has to work in concert with the plan that the court approved. So quite a challenge down there. Good news is, when you get together with the Flood Control Zone 3, the Lopez Project advisors, the Northern Cities Management Area, which is the groundwater management group, with the agencies that state says are eligible to participate in the groundwater sustainability plan, it turns out to be all of the same players with all of the same representatives. There's just not that many water managers in those cities in the county in that area. So we end up playing three or four different roles to meet three or four different goals, which fortunately are consistent with one another. So while it's an acronym minefield, it should turn out to be a good plan moving forward. And there is a thing called a habitat conservation plan on the side, which is also got to be brought together with it. And I mentioned that to DWR, and they just looked at me like, well, good luck. Let us know how that turns out, like a lot of things are. Los Osos Groundwater Basin. As you have probably heard, litigation, groundwater adjudication litigation, has been going on for some 8 years or more in Los Osos. The parties, primarily the water purveyors with the county, are close to going back to court with a basin management plan that's designed to achieve sustainability much the same way that the state law would require. We anticipate some paperwork through the court, and then some deference from DWR regarding actual boundaries of the basin. This big basin, and all of these, in fact, were, these maps were created by the state between 1970 and 1980 using topographic maps, soil maps, and aerial photos. So when I'm out in the community, people will look at me and say, that's a ridiculous map. And I say, well, that's what it looks like if you stand on top of the Capitol and focus really well. That's all they had to use. So we're in a process now of submitting hydrogeologic information, technical information, to the state to identify the more appropriate management boundaries. This one does get a lot smaller and is primarily the developed area of Los Osos with a little bit to the east. So we're hopeful that the basin management plan will be adopted. Funding will be another issue, as everything in Los Osos, there's quite a funding burden on the community with the wastewater project going on. But we continue to work with the state on grant opportunities for that. And then, of course, Paso Robles has been in the news. The question before the community is going to be whether or not they should form a water management district to participate in this larger groundwater management effort. That will be back at the board, I believe, next month for some technical issues related to an upcoming election that we anticipate in next spring. And the question before the voters in the rural area is, do you want to have your own district to then represent those landowners on this larger basin-wide groundwater effort, or would you like the county to do that, or the flood control district? How are we going to accomplish this task of complying with state law regarding groundwater management? And then San Luis Groundwater Basin, this one, as you can see, the city of San Luis is in pink there, and it actually extends up along 101 and up towards Cal Poly. The only agencies eligible to participate in this groundwater management effort are the county, the flood control district, the city, and Golden State Water Company out in the country club area. So we are organizing those folks so that we can go out to the larger community, the farmers primarily, and find out what their preference is for representative being represented properly on a groundwater sustainability agency. This basin, as far as technical information, has by far the least amount of hydrologic information among the five. So there'll be quite a bit of work to do to find out exactly what it is we have. There are some older DWR reports with some estimates, quite a bit of variance between reports. So a lot of work needs to be done so we understand really what we're dealing with there. And then the Cuyama Groundwater Basin. This one is turning out to be really interesting. Out in the southeast corner of our county, it actually touches four counties, San Luis, Santa Barbara, Ventura, and Kern. So we have been in conversation with the other three counties, along with the New Cuyama Community Services District, which is the water purveyor in the little town out there. Santa Barbara County's invested, along with the U.S. Geological Survey, several million dollars in groundwater reports over the last 5 years. Their reports show that the safe yield of the basin, and I'm giving you round numbers, is about 60,000 acre feet a year. For comparison, Paso Robles is close to 30,000 acre feet a year. The pumping is about 60,000 acre feet a year. Some of the wells in the last 15 years have dropped over 600 feet in the Cuyama Basin. And the majority of the deep water being pumped is in a formation that has not had recharge for at least 3,000 years. So they have an underground tank that's not refilling, and it is supporting a very robust irrigated agricultural economy in the valley. A couple of large farming families have discovered a market for organic green leafy vegetables. I think if you go to the supermarket and you buy the little plastic thing and it says baby greens organic, there's a good chance it came from the Cuyama Valley. So we are working with Santa Barbara County and Ventura to engage the community and talk about possibilities for managing that basin and bringing it back closer to sustainability. But there is quite a task there. The USGS report in its conclusion was very negative. Their experts concluded that if you brought the groundwater pumping to a sustainable level, you could not carry on agriculture in the valley. There wouldn't be enough irrigation to justify the investment of even planting and harvesting, that the area would be so small. And then conversely, if you reduced agriculture to its lowest amount that would be sustainable, there wouldn't be enough water to support it. Many of the farmers out there would respectfully disagree, so we're hopeful that they have some information that the USGS didn't have, and something can be done to sort of maintain a community in New Cuyama, which is currently based on agriculture. Then, of course, the state of California is always eager to help in a drought. So one of the things they've done is given us new rules and things to report on, being a little cynical there. But I wanted to get these up on the screen. These are statewide regulations, emergency regulations, and some of them are obvious, you know, washing down the sidewalk, watering your lawn so the water runs off, or not having a shut off on your hose when you wash the car. I don't know who has a water feature that doesn't recirculate, but these kinds of things. What's interesting, when you do this presentation in the rural area, some will say, but I'm on a well. Technically, if you're on a well and you wash your car without a nozzle on the hose, the state can give you a ticket. That's a crime in the state of California. It doesn't matter where the water came from, which some people kind of frown about. Those of us in the urban area, you'll see that all of the water suppliers have issued irrigation day restrictions. We're required to inspect water systems, and even if we can stand in the street and look in your front yard and see a leak, to have a notification procedure. And we report on a monthly basis to the state, and that's why you see those articles about which communities have done how much conservation and whatnot. These rebates have just come out. Now, some communities have had these for a long time. In Los Osos, there's been a toilet rebate program now running for 3 years, I think, in conjunction with the wastewater project. Several of our local cities have been doing turf replacement. These programs are run by contractors through the state of California, through the Proposition 1 water bond. And they're available to access through that website. The local agencies, your local water purveyors, not involved in administering these rebates, so people have to go to the internet to find out how that works, what the requirements are. The county itself, I mentioned we're a water purveyor in Chandon, Santa Margarita, and Cayucas. We're sort of a sub-purveyor in the Ops Center area. We get our water from The county gets its water from the flood control district. Same staff, so there can be some interesting conversations. All of it's wheeled through a system that's operated by the California Department of Correction. So they get all the water, and then they run the water system. And it's a complicated process. But we have, of course, implemented the outdoor water use regulations in the communities I mentioned. We're in constant contact with Department of Water Resources regarding state water. It's not just the total amount of water, but what months are they going to run? What are our turnout rates? All kinds of planning goes involved in that. And then we have created regional plans and projects for high-risk areas. I mentioned the low reservoir response plan. We are currently building an emergency water line between Atascadero and Santa Margarita, which we were able to finance with two separate grants to cover 100% of the $2 million cost, some from the state and some from the federal government. We talk constantly with some of our partners, not county water systems, but for example, Cambria. We help them. The county is the lead agency for DWR grants through Proposition 84 and also Prop 1. And we've been working with Cambria to make sure all the paperwork's done and the stuff that wasn't done gets done so they can be eligible to receive reimbursement from the state through those grant funds. Which is the last bullet there. So we seek funding for systems in need of assistance, whether or not they are county systems. That's part of something called the Integrated Regional Water Management Plan. Again, another interesting presentation, but it describes how all of the water purveyors in the county work together to accomplish common goals. The Parks guys wanted me to show you this. One of our major water users is the parks, so they have done quite a bit to reduce water use in the parks and sports fields, digital computerized irrigation controllers, and you'll see a lot of parks where there's passive turf, nobody's playing games on it, it's just gone brown. I'm told that most turf grasses, if it turns brown and you don't walk on it, if it rains, the grass will come back. And I guess it depends on how long. I've seen some grass that dried up and blew away. I don't know if that's going to come back or not. They are re-landscaping areas as funding is available. These polymers and soil wetting agents are kind of a new thing, so we have some test plots out in our parks to see how well they work. I see one of the local hardware companies advertising a project that you spray on your lawn, and it causes, according to the advertisement, the water to that you spray to go directly to the roots. Not sure how that works, but we are testing some of that and doing all kinds of adjustments. They have folks out there tracking all of the irrigation. So you'll see this kind of thing. Passive areas are brown, and then the sports field is green as a safety issue, obviously, and a resiliency issue. A nice picture of Dairy Creek Golf Course out on the way to Morro Bay. Dairy Creek is interesting in that most of the irrigation is reclaimed wastewater from the wastewater plant that serves the Chero Valley and California Men's Colony. Conservation means less water use and less flow to the wastewater system, which means less reclaimed water for golf courses. So now it looks like that. And I'm told if you're a good golfer, that's not a problem. And if you're an average golfer, it can be somewhat frustrating, I guess, and dusty. Some of the results, this is from the Ops Center. That's all the stuff out there at Kansas Avenue and Camp San Luis Obispo. The blue line at the top is 2013. And then in 2014, they got serious about a year ago and dropped their water use. And then you can see the gray line for 2015. So 4,100 cubic feet of water per month down to around 2,500, 2,600. So it's a fairly successful effort. And considering this includes some facilities like animal services and the jail, which are very difficult to reduce water use. So with that, I'll stop and try to answer any questions that you might have about all of this.
Are there any questions from commissioners? Pretty thorough presentation, Mark. Commissioner Warren?
Thank you. That was a very interesting presentation. I had Three different questions. The first one is regarding the Salinas Reservoir and possibly enlarging that. I thought I heard something or read something in the paper about that recently, that there was some discussion mm-hmm. on that.
Salinas Reservoir, as you probably know, built in 1942, includes the dam and the pipeline up there off the side of Highway 101 opposite Tassajara Creek Road is what we call the booster station. The water from the reservoir, gravity flows to that, and it's pumped up to a tunnel that goes through Cuesta Grade and then down into Camp San Luis Obispo. It was all built in about 9 months, designed and built in about 9 months, by the Army to supply Camp San Luis. There's some wonderful historic documents in the file from the city of San Luis Obispo. It's just some very careful writing. I guess the city was running out of water in 1941 and had thought that they would go put wells in the Chorro Valley. Then along came the Army and said, we're going to bring in 50,000 soldiers. So the city wrote a letter to the Army and said, well, if you do that, well, we won't have any water. And if you bring in 50,000 soldiers, our city's going to expand and there'll be all these businesses, and this is the delicate writing, that come along with 50,000 young men moving into the area. So they made a deal that the city would be a partner with the federal government on the project. They built it. It rained. It has never delivered a drop of water to the military. They just, the pipe actually ended. They never connected the pipe. But they also didn't complete the dam necessarily. It was built to have a floodgate put on top of it, which would raise the reservoir about 19 feet and double the capacity. So with the drought and the fact, as I mentioned earlier, that it will spill in a normal rain, there's been some thought about enlarging the reservoir. Back 15 years or so ago, the city was moving down that project and then decided to abandon it because of the Nacimiento project. So they went with Nacimiento in a partnership. The issue now is that the dam itself is a federal facility and it meets all federal safety standards for a dam, but California has stricter standards. The federal government won't retrofit the dam or put the floodgates on. They say, if you want to do that, we'll give it to you, charge you a buck or something like that. But the instant it becomes a state facility or non-federal, then Sacramento will swoop in and say, first, you can't keep any water in there, and second, you have to do millions upon millions of dollars worth of work for an earthquake retrofit in order to store more water. So we've been looking at that from a funding perspective, a process perspective, trying to find the funding to find out exactly how much work would have to be done. And there's different opinions about that. So those discussions are ongoing, I guess, is the best thing. But we know from the city's effort back, I want to say 2001, 2002, something like that, there's quite an environmental impact from raising the dam 19 feet and flooding quite a bit of larger area. So that has to be considered for any raising project. But it may be a player in the future. It may not. But it has been talked about.
Thank you. Another question along those same lines. I hear you mentioned that the city of SLO gets their water from these different reservoirs. And there is that groundwater basin in the San Luis Obispo Valley. Do they have any wells or anything there that they get water from?
Up until about 1992, the city did rely quite heavily on groundwater wells down in the Los Osos Valley Road, Highway 101 area. And if you'll recall, they pumped those heavily in the last major drought. And then spent quite a bit of money rebuilding some businesses that were, I guess the city would say, allegedly damaged by their pumping. In our conversations with the city, they do have at least one well, which they don't use for the city. They've made that available for residents over the groundwater basin to truck water, non-potable water. It's a shallow well and signed that way so people can come in and fill their tanks and barrels to water their gardens and feed their animals and whatnot. And their long-term plans do not include accessing the groundwater. The city does produce a substantial amount of recycled water and would be an excellent partner in a groundwater management agency using that groundwater management agency as the marketing format or process to move recycled water from the city out to vineyards and farms and whatnot. So there's some things to be gained from that.
So that brings up a question. So does Cal Poly have any wells?
Cal Poly, we understand, does have some wells for their farm stuff, but my understanding is they don't produce any potable water for campus use from groundwater.
Well, it sounds like a nice project between those two and the recyclable water. Okay, and my third question, because of the expansion, is there anything talked about with the expansion of Lopez Lake?
There was an engineering feasibility study done recently by some of the Lopez partners, not all participated, to examine whether or not raising Lopez Dam and Reservoir would produce more water. And preliminary estimates showed that it could over the long term. But those estimates are based on hydrologic data that does not include the current drought period. So they want to take another look at that. They had some preliminary plans about simply raising the lip of the spillway and whether or not it would maintain the appropriate what's called freeboard. So when you have the massive amount of rain, you know, Department of Safety of Dams wants to see a certain amount of, you know, space. And that was looking good, but DSOD tends to be very, very conservative, which is a good thing. And their final preliminary decision was that raising the spillway was fine, but they wanted to keep the exact same freeboard that the dam currently has. So that means raising the dam, and there's a road with a bridge in the middle of it, so you add several million dollars to the cost there. So they want to go back. It's on hold at the moment, but the team would go back and look at those costs, and then also apply the last 4 years of hydrologic data to the reservoir and rerun the models. The when you look at a graph of inflow to Lopez reservoirs, you can imagine you have numbers on the high side that exceed the capacity or watershed production. And then you come all the way down to 1990 or 1987 to 92, and you see some very low inflow numbers. The last 4 years have been half of the next lowest inflow number. So when we talk about unprecedented, Lopez is the classic example. We don't have any record on which to base predictions about recovery time or rainfall or anything else, because we're well outside the line that the previous 40 years would predict. So it's talked about, and there's preliminary work done on it, but not progressing at this point.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
I have just one more question. If you stated it, I missed it, and I apologize. Where does Atascadero State Hospital get its water?
Don't know.
Oh, you didn't state that. Okay.
I do not. I know they're in the boundaries of the Mutual Water Company, but I don't know if they're a customer of the Mutual Water Company or not.
Okay. And they don't. You don't know if they produce any water?
They do have a wastewater plant that discharges.
Okay.
Into the Salinas River.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for commissioners for Mr. Hutchinson? Thank you very much. That was very interesting, and I don't know how you could have been more thorough.
Thank you.
Good evening, Commissioner Enns and members of the Health Commission. I am Gina Herbst, GIS Analyst for the Environmental Health Services. I'm currently responsible for creating and mapping environmental health program facilities such as water wells and water service areas, hazmat underground storage facilities, food facilities, and pools as well. I also create and manage web-based map viewers for our staff and customers and provide training and project-focused analysis, GIS analysis. I will be presenting I will be presenting an overview of GIS, or Geographic Information Systems, and how we are benefiting from GIS in our water programs and in the workflows for our programs by connecting the geography of our regulated facilities to our project management system. So basically, we have our mapping backed up by a very powerful database of information. So interactive mapping allows us to visualize, question, and interpret layers of information to better understand relationships, patterns, and trends. This is HealthView, our internal map viewer. It is an all-staff-friendly interactive map viewer that non-GISers, GIS users can benefit from. And this is an example of some spatial analysis that we performed on some of the basin boundaries. And this was asking the GIS, please tell us what water wells are within the basin boundaries or basin-related boundaries, and please break it down by well type. So this is something that the database can generate very quickly without any type of physical research through files. So GIS allows integration of layers of environmental health data along with countywide enterprise layers, such as roads and utilities from public works, political boundaries and permitting data from planning, and parcel data from the assessor. So let's jump to Los Osos here to see some of our in-house GIS layers that we manage. We have water wells that are mapped from 1990 to present. We have the water purveyors layer, which is comprised of mostly smaller water service areas. And we also have our hazmat facilities as the green dots. So far, we have over 12,000 water well records mapped. We approximate another 13,000 or so that still need to be mapped, and these are the pre-1990 records. We are currently going through a reorganization of our well documents that are stored on an off-site facility. Once those are reorganized, we can start a major scanning project where we will scan all of the well documents, which include water well applications and well completion reports. Once all that data is digitized, then we can tie that information to the GIS so that every approximate location of a well will be tied to all of that information. And we will implement a public-facing map viewer. We also maintain Water Purveyors View. This is another web-based map viewer that is used in the field by CAL FIRE. And this is part of their contingency plan to quickly identify the location of a call and to determine which water system is appropriate to draw water from based on the drought assessment. The drought assessment was a one-time survey questionnaire that was completed and returned by participating water systems. This information was assessed and classified by our EH staff for internal purposes only. Our staff relies on GIS heavily throughout the water well permitting process. We use GIS to verify property ownership and history against the assessor parcel layer, and we verify if a proposed well site is within an emergency ordinance area or within the coastal zone boundary. We also verify if the GPS coordinates of the proposed site that are provided by the well driller are actually within the recorded parcel. That's pretty important. GIS is also used to fulfill public service requests, and this is an example on the screen of a customer just walking into our office, and he has an APN number for his property, and he would like to know all of the water wells that have been permitted on his property. So we can provide him information digitally from 1990 to the present, then we have to do some extra digging for the wells from prior to 1990. Our admin staff can query the parcels within a water service area to quickly generate mailing notices by parcel address information. These notices can be sent to residents that are served by the water system. For example, if there's a water quality issue and a bottled water notice needs to be communicated to the public, this is a very quick and easy way to get that information out. Our hazmat staff performs risk analysis to determine what sensitive receptors fall within a distance buffer. And this is an example that reveals sensitive receptors, as they call it, that fall within a half-mile buffer radiating from a hazmat facility. If this was a chlorine tank, the hazmat inspector could quickly analyze a gas plume scenario and access the data within the buffer, such as where the schools are, hospitals, and parcels for emergency assessment. Layers from the Office of Emergency Services, such as fire stations, evac zones and routes, decontamination sites, and timely public works, street opening, and rerouting information can be included in the analysis as well. Analysis typically performed to determine if there are wells within 1,500 feet from a hazmat underground storage tank, such as gas stations, for risk assessment purposes. That's a type of analysis that is routinely done by the hazmat team. Ocean water monitoring sites have been mapped and maintained by Environmental Health, and there are, I think there are 18 sites that are monitored every week, and they're mapped and symbolized by the current beach status. This map viewer component will be a future replacement for the current ocean water monitoring page on the county website. And this will be very handheld, mobile device friendly, so you can use it while you're at the beach. Well, that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions from your commission?
Questions from commissioners? Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much. I kind of got fascinated by your maps there. I'd like to go through them all again, but I guess not. But it was interesting as the question that popped into my mind, you said the words hazmat, and I went, oh, hazardous materials in underground storage. But then your maps sort of helped identify a little bit of it. Because what my question was going to be is, we have hazardous materials stored underground in our county? Oh, see how ignorant yes. I am? But
yeah, absolutely.
You popped in picture of the city, and I'm like, ooh, one's right by my house. So it's like, could you elaborate a little about hazardous materials underground?
I should probably help you out
sure.
with that one.
Oh, sure.
Every gas station has gasoline,
okay,
which comprise the vast majority of our underground are hazardous materials that mm-hmm. are underground.
Yeah.
There's also waste oil tanks and that sort of thing, but by far it's the gasoline and diesel
okay.
fuel that's underground.
But your data capturing is pretty interesting there. Is right near me is a senior care facility, and I noticed it flagged as in hazardous materials there.
Yes, you can actually have, but they probably don't have underground storage of those, but
okay.
They could have them on site, because we also know where all the hazardous materials are above a certain quantity.
Mm-hmm.
We know where they are throughout the county.
That's
and
right.
we have those also
mapped in a general way, mm-hmm. as well as specific maps for that particular facility that will say, you know, we store 50 gallons of methyl ethyl bad stuff over here in the mm-hmm. corner of this piece of property. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is if the fire department has to go out and put out a fire, they want to know where this stuff is. So right. all of this information is electronically available to all of the fire agencies that want to use
Great.
It. It's available. And yeah. we've been doing that for quite some time now.
Oh, okay. So I'm hoping your PowerPoint will pass through Jean so that she can share it, because there was one right by my house, so I'm really going to worry about that now. Yes, and my focus really is on health concerns, that sort of thing, so I'm going to pull Mark into this one too. He used the phrase county water. And you mentioned county water, Mark? And it's when you were talking about Nacimiento Lake supply. I was kind of curious, where does the testing responsibility lie for that water? Obviously, if it comes to the city of SLO, I can figure that one out. It's our own treatment plant. But in less, you know, urban-style areas, who's responsible for testing it?
Well, Nacimiento water is interesting in that the county tests the lake around the intake structure.
Okay.
For a number of things, certainly health concerns mm-hmm. And metals, as you can imagine, because
right.
of the Nacimiento watershed, mm-hmm. which at that point we haven't detected any. But we look at a lot of constituents for all of our dams looking for the best water at different levels of the reservoir. All of the intake structures have windows, if you will, that we can open and close. Mm. So we like to take water that's easiest to treat at the other end of the pipe. That testing is done by Public Works, our water lab. We have 9 staff based at our water lab out of Kansas Avenue, Camp San Luis Obispo, and they do the majority of the water tests for all of the county-run systems and then subcontract to some of the smaller water agencies around the county. It's a state-certified lab, and that's where we do all of the required testing.
Wow. So this is good. It's like the Nacimiento, back to that one, being tested right at the, you know, the dam head, if I understood right. That's we're getting
yes.
it there, and then when the actual recipient gets it, like the city, they can test it again. It's
yes.
pretty sophisticated. Okay, that's great. Okay, my other water quality question is, does any monitoring or water quality testing exist for areas around the Price Canyon area where hydraulic fracking is going on?
That's a pretty good topic all by itself.
Sure is.
Fracking. Unless there's a water system there that is providing water to someone, and I'm not sure if there is, then there would be no water testing done.
Okay.
It's usually that water testing that is done is usually associated with the delivery of water to customers.
Right.
People who have their own individual wells,
mm-hmm.
they could have it, but they aren't required by anybody to do any testing. They're kind of on their own to do their own testing.
Okay. And not to put you in the hot seat here, Kurt, but of the hydraulic fracking that's going on there, I just used the word hydraulic water. Are you aware of there's any of that as chemically laced water?
You know, I've actually participated in a small task force that did a little bit of research. And I'm trying to reflect back on that. And I think that there's multiple forms of stimulating a well.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, of which is to go hydraulically fracture the soils below and pull out gas or mm-hmm. or oil or whatever. There's also other ones that use chemicals of various kinds that also might do the same thing, but they do it chemically rather than with water pressure and sand and literally force it open. But I can't tell you right now, I can't remember if there was any, I seem to remember that there, at least at the time that we did this, they weren't aware of any that were using chemicals to stimulate the well. I think there was some proposals to do so, but I don't think it's actually going on yet. But I don't hold me to that because I'm going from memory from about a year ago, and
okay.
that's tough.
Is there some county office or something that is pretty knowledgeable in that subject matter?
We've been working with county planning primarily to do some research into that. The ones who are really the most knowledgeable are state level. Yes. They call them DOGGR, the Department of Oil and Gas. And they are the ones who actually are responsible for regulating that activity. Yeah. We don't regulate that activity locally.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
Commissioner Warren, go ahead.
I just had one clarification on the GIS program. And I think I might have dozed a minute there, but you were talking about them being able to see what the conditions are at the beach, and is that if there's any toxicity in the water?
Correct. That's from the ocean monitoring testing that's done every week. That's from the monitoring, the testing lab results that are made every week at every site.
I should probably clarify.
Yeah.
We only test for bacteria. We don't test for chemicals. So there's it's all bacteriological in nature. The testing, it's all about fecal coliform, total coliform, and an organism that's associated with that is Enterococcus. And so it's all about those three and their standards that are set up that we apply when we and if they exceed a certain standard, it's either a health advisory or if we actually have something we know was associated with a sewage spill or something like that, we can actually then close access to the beach.
Thank you. That's wonderful. We spent many hours in here listening and hearing reports from the Surf Riders group and everybody else, and I'm really glad to hear that you've got something up and running and that is being monitored regularly and the public can access it.
Thank it's you. All available right now on our website.
All right.
Is it? Well, we got one more piece, my piece, whenever you're ready. The part that I'm charged with is talking a little bit about the public health impacts of drought. It seems obvious, I think, to a lot of people, but we all understand the importance of clean, potable water in adequate supply, you know, to prevent diseases, and that's been known for a long time. In fact, that's sort of a cornerstone of public health, dating back hundreds of years. But we know that it can deal with things like cholera and dysentery and all of those things that are associated with poor sanitation. But believe it or not, there's not a lot of information out there about the public health impacts of a drought, of the lack of water. There's some a certain amount of data out there, a certain amount of information, but it's not as complete as you might think. And that's one thing I was kind of surprised at as I was doing a little bit of homework. But let me talk a little bit about what we do know about the possibility of what a drought might cause in terms of public health. First of all, when you reduce the quantity of water in a stream or in a lake, you concentrate the pollutants that are in that lake, whether they be chemical or bacteriological or whatever they are. Less water, pollutants didn't go away. That means your concentration is going to go up. Higher temperature of water, which you typically a drought is associated with higher temperatures, less water, then the water temperature goes up, increases oxygen levels in the water, which can have an effect on the aquatic life that's normally there, which could also have its own problems associated with the quality of that water. The runoff that comes from our fires and our dry soils, when we do finally get rain, all that water, all that runoff, all that ash, all that whatever got burned in the fire, and you've seen pictures of houses being burned, and some of the most contaminated places we have in the county are within homes because they got, you know, plastics and household chemicals and some kind of a concoction of who knows what when you finally burn it all and you put it out with a fire hose, and then that flows into a stream, they can be very problematic and largely unknown, because who knows what it was? It just wouldn't know. The problem with low water flows into our groundwater, to recharge our groundwater, if you don't have it and you're in a coastal area, you can have salt water migrating into the drinking water. And so that's, obviously, salt water is not something you want to have happen. So there's actually counties and jurisdictions that make an extra effort to inject water into their aquifer to keep that from occurring, because that can be pretty devastating. In the area of food and nutrition, less water oftentimes translates into lower crop yields. Lower crop yields translate into more expensive food. If you are at the lower end of the economic scale, perhaps you will buy food that is less expensive, and not, you know, because the food that is nutritious for you, you may not be able to afford. So it does have an effect on public health from a sort of a nutrition point of view. Same thing with cattle. Cattle that are grazing low during a drought, there's less food available, natural food. They are become malnourished, or typically can. And if they do, then that malnourished makes them more susceptible to disease. That ends up in our food supply. That can have a problem. These are all, a lot of these are speculative, or they are, you know, we don't have necessarily a lot of data to, but people are trying to think of what exists during a drought, and then, you know, follow the thought to what kind of problems it could result. The other thing that's obvious is very dry soils, more dust is in the air. If you are a sufferer of chronic lung respiratory diseases, it makes that worse. Asthma, you know, something that we experience here in this county is valley fever. So it raises the risk of valley fever more and more. The idea that, you know, there was some discussion a little bit about reclaimed water and recycled water. And I haven't seen this happen. I do not know of it occurring at this point. But at some point, if water became scarce enough, farmers might have to use reclaimed or recycled water to irrigate with. If that were necessary, that's not a bad thing necessarily in and of itself, but it does require a great deal more monitoring. And it's different than using the, you know, water out of a well and putting it on your crops. But if you've got recycled water, you do need to monitor that much closer. So it's just more work, more risk of problems that could be associated with that. Low water generally, drought conditions generally result in less hydroelectric power, making electricity more expensive. Well, if you're on that lower end of the economic scale and you happen to be a vulnerable population, these high heat days that we've been experiencing, if you can't afford the electricity to run the air conditioning, you've got all of the potential issues associated with exposure to high heat conditions. This is probably getting a little bit out there, but you know, lack of water may translate into, if you're trying to conserve water, less hand washing, less fruit and vegetable washing, you know, just kind of those kinds of things that we currently haven't experienced. But then there's always another summer of no water, and we may have problems with that. Right now, none of the restrictions say don't wash your hands, certainly. But just people thinking, oh, I want to do the right thing, you know, and they do things on their own. And contrary to popular belief, drought conditions can actually result in more mosquito populations. The first thought you think is, drought, no water, why would I have more mosquitoes? Well, what happens is rivers and creeks that used to flow now are starting to stop flowing, creating stagnant pools of water, which then is ideal for mosquitoes. So it's very localized conditions. It might be in some areas where maybe there's, if there is no water where there used to be, but now there's new areas where the water used to flow and it doesn't flow, so now you have mosquitoes. It also, the wildlife comes down out of the hills to be more, to look for water, and they carry Lyme disease, ticks that carry Lyme disease, so they're now in closer association with the human population, increases the risk of diseases, zoonotic diseases. That now, again, I want to stress that these are speculative in nature. They are people trying to plan for extreme drought conditions. So it's not something that you go out and these conditions that you can go out and measure are actually occurring. I couldn't tell you that. We don't know. But they certainly have that potential. And the bottom line message I want to leave you with is much more research needs to be done about drought and its direct impact on public health. It's it is a what I call a slow motion disaster that's occurring over time, and most disasters have a public health component that causes problems for all of us. So that concludes our presentation on water and public health issues. Can I answer any questions on the public health side of things?
Commissioner Warren.
Yes, I thank you again. It was a great presentation all the way around. I do have a question. I read an article recently on the low flow to no flow urinals and that the city of Pismo is putting them in. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if the county was looking at putting that in different public facilities and if they had any thoughts about that.
Well, I do know that in our drought task force meetings, there have been discussions about low-flow urinals, low-flow toilets, sink, water fixtures, things like that to try to reduce water. I know they are doing that sort of thing now, and I know that they plan on expanding that, the use of that. But the no-flow, and I have heard of it, the no-flow urinals, I don't know how they work. I mean, you got to have water. Yeah.
Well, Commissioner Kington Barker, and then Commissioner Scott or Smith.
Question: as water resources get closer to minimum pool, is it necessary to add more chemicals to the water in order to continue to keep it active, pure? Is that
well,
a
you, well? You might that might be a conclusion you would draw if some of the people who are thinking about this, if the less water results in higher concentrations of
right.
bacteria, then yes, it would require higher levels of chemicals to sanitize that water.
Is that of the things that you're talking about, and when you've said that there really isn't a lot of research about this or a lot of data. Is it something that here in California we're looking into, or is data is being kept now?
Well, a lot of what I was reading was from federal CDC, the
okay.
Communicable Disease folks, mm-hmm. EPA. Those were the sources I was looking at. I don't know what's going on in California in terms of doing any research in that.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, that's done at the federal level. But I don't really know.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I think this is a great topic tonight on the water, and Mark's presentation was good, except I think he left out how much did we gain today from all that rain? Oh.
You know, I have to wash my truck, which probably means I'm in trouble because I probably have to use some water to deal with it. But.
Well, Mr. Batson, I really appreciate it was interesting, as you did elaborate, there isn't a lot of science on this drought side of it, the impacts on health, and you did some real digging on it. I'm thinking maybe if you gave the county another 10 years or so of time, you could just keep working on this topic.
Maybe. Well, it is a, you know, I do believe that, you know, California has a history of droughts, you know, periodic droughts. But one thing's for sure, we also have a history of increased population, and at least the long range predictions about water availability is not predicting we're going to get more water commensurate with the population growth. In fact, what I'm reading more often is over the last 100 years or so, we've actually been in a relatively wet cycle, so that you might expect that even though there might be wet years, the available water may be, per person particularly, may not be as good as it has been when all this development was occurring. Now what do you do? Talk about long-range planning and thinking about it. It's one thing to conserve, but at some point, you just got X amount of people and probably not more water. You only can worry about or use existing water, maybe make it work 3 or 4 times in the form of recycling and reclaiming water, trying to do it that way. But the amount of water available is going to be about the same.
Thank you very much. That's an interesting concept. We could just shut the door, I suppose.
Well, we know that's really not one of the
options. It doesn't work.
No.
No, of course it doesn't. We really appreciate all the work that you all have gone to bring us an interesting presentation on a subject that has been of interest, I think, to the Health Commission, but never quite certain how we were going to learn about it or what we would do with what we learned. But I do hope that since we are viewed publicly, that a lot of people will have learned something here tonight that they wouldn't otherwise know, and I think we certainly have. And we wish you well in your retirement.
So, well, I'll try to make sure I use less water.
Okay. Yeah, don't forget to wash your hands.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's probably not going to happen. I won't forget.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. We appreciate your participation. Moving on our agenda, we move directly now to the Health Commissioner updates. I don't have any particular update. Let me start at my left, and we'll just move down the line here if there are updates.
Thought so. Well, I did want to share with you about the fact that I am the liaison on the San Luis Obispo County Commission on Aging, and we had a rather interesting topic for their last meeting. But before I get into the detail on that one, I just want to let you know about the one coming up. It's on September 18th, starts at 10 a.m. at the San Luis Obispo County Veterans Building. It's mental health services for the elderly. So they'll have quite a meaty one there that they're going to have presentations on. So the most recent meeting on August 21st was Our Changing Healthcare Landscape, right here in our own county. It was put on by Alan Iftinek, which is the CEO of French Hospital, and Ron Uchelson, Chief Business Development Officer for Tenet. And it was interesting to listen to these gentlemen. They didn't really want to give us a PowerPoint and just lecture us to death. So I thought they were rather brave, as they asked just the members of the commission and the public, tell me what your experiences have been like. Where's your concerns? So initially, people weren't willing to start hammering at them, so they talked about the new electronic health records. That's quite an initiative that is coming into the health industry. Those two gentlemen, my God, are they excited about it. And it took me a minute to really get my arms around it, is what is kind of interesting about it. Which is, they described the long-term potential by using this example. What if someone has a health crisis and they're on the East Coast, but they live here in San Luis Obispo? As we grow into having better electronic records, that person having this thing on the East Coast, who none of the doctors have any clue what this person's health history is like, could actually log into those electronic records and have a much better handle of what's been going on for the last 10 to 15 years in this person while they're maybe in a coma. So I started to get their excitement a little bit, but apparently it's been quite a monster undertaking where people did start talking to the commission about the fact that when they've been in hospitals, they notice the nurses aren't just jotting down handwritten notes anymore. They're concerned that, wow, is that nurse even paying attention to me? When in reality, it's the new learning curve for the, you know, all the support staff there in a hospital setting. They've got to all be electronic. They said, absolutely no one, doctors, anyone who's serving that patient, cannot just do handwritten notes. It all has to be electronic now. So that was quite an education for me. Another one that they pointed out was, it's really great that things like Covered California came along, which created a lot more health insurance, people with health insurance. So now when they show up in the ER, actually some of them have an ability to pay. Even more Medi-Cal people are now signed up. However, what's happening, the usage at the ERs is skyrocketing because people aren't as fearful about going to the ER thinking, how can I ever pay for it? So it was part of their justification for why are we observing both Tenet and Dignity establishing primary care clinics locally? Why are they seeming to be buying up private practices? Well, they said that's part of getting people out of the ER, is they'll finish with a client in an ER, a patient in an ER, and tell them, now we need you to see your family doctor for follow-up, and they'll look at them, the patient will look at them like, what family doctor? You know, I'm lucky I found a place to get health care, as in the ER. So they're using that as some of their explanation that they want to have facilities for people to go to. And they feel as hospital corporations, they can recruit doctors maybe a little more effectively than a private practice. So that was an interesting tidbit of them. I kind of put them in the hot seat too, because it reminds you again, I'm on the board as a HICAP representative, which is the Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program. Well, I had a recent client that has gone to one of these new, if you will, hospital-owned facilities, and they found that the cost had tripled for identical radiological services by a well-known testing facility right here in San Luis Obispo, after the ownership was basically taken over by a hospital corporation. And at first, I was reluctant to believe it, and I did validate those charges, that it was exactly the same procedure codes, but had tripled in cost. So I asked them during this presentation, gave them that scenario, and they indicated the professional standards for a hospital as an owner, it's much higher than for a private practice standards, which requires a significant upgrades by the hospital corporation itself, while maybe not readily seen by the patient. So all in all, I thought that was a pretty good meeting.
No report.
So two short reports. The San Luis Obispo County Intimate Partner Violence Coalition. We're planning our annual educational forum for the end of October. Hopefully at our meeting next month, we'll have somebody come and describe the program and what they're talking about. But because domestic violence is reportable and also now payable through the Accountable Care Act, we're trying to educate the providers in the community about recognizing the signs of DV. And by providers, not only our physicians, but our therapists, anybody that works with children. So it's going to be a program that's going to be co-sponsored. Well, we as the health commissioner are actually one of the stakeholders as well as public health on it. But the program's going to be participating with our women's shelter, RISE. Part of it will be funded by the Blue Shield Foundation, because we here in our county applied for a fairly nice grant and were awarded that grant to do this program. So we'll be able to offer both continuing ed units for nurses, therapists, and continuing ed units for physicians as well. Then the Healthy Communities work group, which is part of Heal Slow, continues to meet on a monthly basis. We review three or four plans from the planning department, each meeting looking at it from a health perspective for whatever the plan is. So part of what we had tonight is our presentation goes hand in hand with what we're doing with Healthy Communities, at looking at climate action plans for all of our cities as well as the different departments in our county. Kathleen Carley, who we all know has more energy than anybody I've ever known, has started the process to apply for some recognition for this particular program that we do in our county, which is one of a few that are done throughout the state. So the governor has initiated a challenge for an innovation challenge, actually, wanting California to become far more active and having healthy communities. So we're going to be submitting our program that we have here in San Luis Obispo. No money involved, just a pat on the back, but I think it will be worth it. So hopefully, we think we put a nice application, I guess you would call it, together. So we will see. I think the awards will be granted sometime the end of October or November, and then the winners will be, or the chosen few, will be invited to Sacramento for some kind of recognition. That's it.
And I'm liaison to the First Five Commission. They continue to work very vigorously on their five-year preliminary strategic plan. No details have emerged. I think some themes that we'll see when we finally get it fleshed out is that they want to put increased stress on family health as it affects the kid, rather than individual efforts with individual children, but recognizing that kids grow up in an environment that is incredibly influential. And probably they'll be emphasizing more strongly perinatal and even prenatal health care. And over all of this is the cloud, if you wish, of decreased tobacco money that they're anticipating. But it's a very, very energetic group, very impressive group of people, and I hope sometime in the next few months to be able to report the final product of this process.
I have no report from the previous HSOC meeting, which I missed this summer, but we will be meeting this Wednesday, so I will have a report for next month. Thank you.
And as mentioned, the San Luis Obispo Coalition for Compassionate Care is meeting once again, and it is also combined with the PULSE meeting, which is the Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. With all of the movement that's been going on with the Aid in Dying bill that has been kind of working its way through the State Congress and the State Senate, on now is with the governor's going before the governor's desk, and a lot of discussion with Medicare coming in January of 2016 about possible reimbursement for physicians to have some kind of financial reimbursement for the time spent with patients to talk about their end-of-life care in detail. There's also a need to educate the community about end-of-life and wishes, and to give them more complete information. So the coalition's mission is really to find ways to educate the community through the continuum of care. And that will assist hospitals in being able to have patients who are better prepared about having made those choices before they come in crisis, families who've had conversations much earlier before the crisis occurs. The San Luis Obispo County Coalition was given a grant through the state coalition to also provide an education to faith leaders. That is an area, too, that a lot of people in the community do depend on having conversations around end-of-life wishes. And sometimes faith leaders are no more prepared than physicians to have those conversations. So it's an opportunity for us to also reach out to the faith communities. So you're going to be seeing over the next year a lot more efforts and collaborative efforts toward educating and making different resources available. And I'll continue to report, or Jean will.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody, for all the time that you've spent and information that you've brought us. I don't believe any committees have met since our last meeting. That would be correct. But stay tuned. Oh, yeah. As far as prospective future items, we have a program lined up for next month. And do you want to give us a little preview, Commissioner Smith-Cook?
Well, we hope to get, you know, some speakers in here to talk about the subject of open enrollment that's occurring for Medicare this fall, and then open enrollment is also occurring for Covered California. So I managed with a little bit of a struggle to get them both to do a presentation in the same evening, which would be October. So our October meeting will have one individual from HICAP, where I am, and she's a very good presenter, and then someone we've enjoyed before, Joel Dieringer, has agreed to come back and talk to us about Covered California, and then something to do with, I believe, the Behavioral Integration Project. He's going to speak to that one also. So stay tuned for next month.
So next month is Domestic Violence Awareness, and hopefully we'll just have a short presentation on the program that they're going to do at the end of the month. We'll ask someone to come for a short time.
Okay, thank you very much. So next month, another interesting time at the Health Commission. There being no further business, this meeting is adjourned, and thank you all very much for being here.